As Mark said, the reading is from Matthew chapter 9 and can be found on page 982, beginning to read at verse 35. And Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, because they were harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest."
Well, thank you for reading, and may I add my welcome to Mark's as we start this new autumn series. There can be no doubt that we live here in London in unsettling times. On Saturday evening, just 500 metres away from our home south of the river, police conducted the raid on the restaurant, removed 14 for questioning, that you will have read and heard about this morning. I'm told Bishopsgate was blocked to traffic. 3 weeks ago at Bristol Airport, on a journey from Bristol to Glasgow, my 11-year-old was ordered to empty his pockets of half-eaten packets of Polos on his British Airways flight and leave them in the clear plastic box. They are unsettling times. So in a series at a time like this, my aim is that we should understand the times in which we live, that we should understand better the terms and conditions of belonging to Jesus in these times, and that we should understand better the ties that Jesus' people have with one another, the network and connections of Jesus' people. Of course, if we fail to understand the times, then we will always be disorientated. And if we fail to understand the terms and conditions in any sphere of life, we'll always end up disillusioned. And if we fail to understand the ties, the networks, then we will always feel ourselves disenfranchised. We read a couple of years ago about the Dorchester Gladiators who went on tour to Romania. The Gladiators are a small rugby club of veteran players from the south coast, and there was a slight error in translation before their tour that meant that instead of playing a side of similarly decrepit 40 to 50-year-olds, they found themselves in Bucharest in the national stadium on national television, playing the Romanian national side, aged average 25. Nigel Jones, a relatively youthful 49-year-old, said, "We started to get worried when our hosts asked us if we wanted to do a training session the night before, which is not exactly our style. We did our pre-match build-up in the bar and didn't get to bed till 4. When the morning came, they started warming up professionally. We just stood about smoking, knowing we were in real trouble." Well, it goes without saying that if we don't understand the times, the terms, conditions, the ties, then we will always end up in real trouble. And there is a danger that we end up in trouble. So to me, this is a really important section of Matthew's Gospel. I have to make a confession. In my first 4 years as rector here, I tried to preach the whole way through all of Matthew's Gospel. And I did miss out one chapter. I mean, you won't remember or may not have noticed. And it was chapter 10. When I came to teach chapter 10 just 2-3 years ago for the first time, I realized what a gem we were missing as Jesus explains the times, terms, and ties of his kingdom. You'll know, I'm sure, that Matthew is broken into 5 major sections. He's a very careful writer. And each section has 2 parts: narrative, explaining the action of Jesus, and then teaching with his disciples as they gather around, and he explains it in detail. And Matthew 9 and 10 are the teaching section, if you like, of the second major part of Matthew's Gospel. And we're going to look today just at one verse, which provides a summary of 8 and 9, the first part of a summary. We'll look at the second part next week. And there it is in verse 35. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction. And I've given the first part of this talk the title, "It is a time for heartfelt conviction, deep conviction. And under this point, I want us to examine the evidence of Jesus' life and to see that it's designed to convince us that Jesus really has been given all of God's authority to rule, that Jesus Christ is God's rescuing king. He is the one who will usher in God's kingdom, free from every aspect of rebellion and God's judgment that so wrecks this world. So that under this point, I want us to see that it is a time now for deep conviction. Now, the whole of the section is designed to make that point from chapter 8 right the way through to the end of chapter 10. And you can see that we're on the right track. As I say, Matthew's a very careful writer. By looking to the first few verses of the next section, which begins in chapter 11, where John the Baptist comes in verse 2 and 3 and asks the question of Jesus, or sends rather his disciples to ask, are you the one to come, or should we expect somebody else? Are you the long-awaited king with all of God's authority who will usher in God's rule and judge God's enemies? Are you the one? And Jesus replies by recapping on everything that he's done in chapter 8, 9, and 10. You can see it there in verse 4. He answered, go and tell John what you hear and see. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have good news preached to them, and blessed is the one who doesn't take offence at me. So all of chapter 8 and 9 through chapter 10 are designed to convince us so that we emerge from the chapters with a deep, heartfelt conviction that Jesus is God's king with all of God's authority over us to usher in God's kingdom. And I thought we would just glance back by way of revision of something we haven't actually looked at recently at the chapter headings. You can see chapter 8. Just look at what the editors have called it. Jesus cleanses a leper. Here is a man who might easily have auditioned as an extra in the 1960s film The Night of the Living Dead. Do you remember it? I hope not. You've probably written it out of your memory. It was such an awful film as corpses rose from the grave and plagued the living. Well, a leper was seen as good as dead already, for the flesh had already begun to rot, and therefore the leper carried the mark of one who is living in a world under God's judgment, where death and decay is the end of all people. As the leper comes to Jesus, what does Jesus do? He has no fear of contamination himself. He reaches out his hand and, verse 3, touched him. Be clean. And immediately the leprosy left him. So straight away, the arrival of God's king. This is God walking on earth with all of his authority. The one who has come to overthrow the effects of God's judgment. The one who will do it by satisfying God's judgment and ushering in God's kingdom. The next heading, you can see this military ruler, the centurion. Here is the equivalent of Brigadier Ed Butler, ex-SAS commander, heading up the British operations in Afghanistan or part of Iraq, I can't remember which. The centurion is not a Jew. He's in charge of the local garrison. He's a military man, and therefore he's used to weighing situations and making sound judgments. He's a man's man. He's not the type of person to be easily taken in. He's not gullible. But he's seen Jesus in operation. And he has his servant who's sick, approaching death. And so he comes to Jesus and he says, Lord, verse 6, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. Jesus says, I'll come and heal him. The centurion replies, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. And then at a distance, with a word, without even going for a kind of diagnostic checkup, Jesus commands and the servant is healed. The point is not hard to get, is it? Here is God's king with all of God's authority. This is the one. The next heading, Jesus enters Peter's house. And in Peter's house, his mother-in-law is lying sick with a fever. And in those days, of course, fever was life-threatening. I came across a contemporary account of fever from a medic who wrote this. What do the swords of tyrants do? They kill. What does fever do? Nothing else. Of course, it did in the days before penicillin. Fever was life-threatening. Somebody else said day 7 decided whether you lived or died if you had a fever. And here is Peter's mother-in-law upstairs with a fever. What does Jesus do? He touches her. The fever left her, and she rose. And that evening, unsurprisingly, they brought him many who were oppressed with demons, overtaken with evil, suffering from sickness, and he healed the lot. The point is not hard to get, is it? But if we are finding it quite hard to get, then in order to drive it right home, you can see verse 23, the calming of the storm. So here is the equivalent of Hurricane Katrina or Boxing Day 2004. Remember waking and hearing of it? And here is Jesus standing, if you like, on the levee in Mississippi or on the beach in South Asia. And here is the raging, chaotic torrent swarming towards him. And Jesus wakes up, gets up, with a word, commands, and all is calm. So as Jesus Christ, God's man, steps onto the pages of first century history, the purpose of this eyewitness account by Matthew, his disciple who spent 3 years with him, is to show us who he is. He is God's king with all of God's authority, who will usher in God's kingdom free from everything that wrecks and spoils this world as we live in a world under God's judgment. He has arrived to demonstrate that he's the rescuing king. And interestingly, I don't know if you know this, if you turn over the page now approaching our verse, we haven't got time to go through the whole lot, but have a look at verse 32 of chapter 9, 33, a demon-oppressed man is brought to him. When the demon had been cast out, the mute man spoke. Now, what do the people who were actually there say? The crowds marveled. Never was anything like this seen in Israel. And notice the Pharisees, they can't deny the supernatural power. And so they say, well, he must cast out demons by some power. He must be the prince of demons. Even his enemies cannot deny the extraordinary power that is at work as Jesus demonstrates his identity. And so to our summary verse of the whole section, you can see why I say it's a summary verse, verse 35. Let me read it slowly and notice how the universal nature of what Jesus is doing is stressed. Jesus went throughout all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel, that's the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and every affliction. I don't know if you thought about this. You know that there was a time in Galilee in the first century when every disease and sickness was healed. If you were with Jesus then, every aspect of this fallen world was dealt with. Death wasn't an issue. There were no ambulance sirens. I love speaking on that verse on Sunday evening because we've got lots of medics with us. And I've often said to them, you know, you'd all be out of a job. The hospitals were empty. Every disease, every sickness, all the towns and all the cities, preaching the good news, the kingdom has come, and demonstrating the fact that the kingdom has come by acting in power in every town and city. It occurred to me as I was preparing for this morning that actually, with lots of insurance people, we can say the same. If you were with Jesus in Galilee in the first century, you'd be out of a job. No hurricanes, no medical claims, no accidents or emergencies, no greedy ambulance chasers, no raising of the premium, just redundancy. Now, it seems to me this is very, very important that we get this summary before we head into chapter 10. We live in a time when we can have deep conviction about the truth of Jesus. We haven't even got to the resurrection of Jesus yet. So I want us to pause and to consider Jesus for a moment, to take our minds off the next deal, off the boss, off the problems at home, whatever, and to realize that this is a time for deep personal conviction. Jesus claims to be God's king, who reverses the effects of God's judgment by overthrowing all of God's enemies and satisfying God's judgment. And as he walks the earth, wherever he is, he demonstrates it. He has power over death to reverse its devastating despair. He has power over creation to calm the chaos. He has power over sickness to silence the suffering. He has power over evil to overthrow and judge all who refuse him. Dostoevsky, the famous author, wrote this: "There is no one lovelier, deeper, more sympathetic, more perfect than Jesus. I say to myself with jealous love that not only is there no one else like him, but there could never be anybody else like Jesus." I remember when I first started work after university, it was a scary time. You may have forgotten, some of you oldies, how scary it is when you start. I was surrounded for the first time in my life by people in their 40s and 50s who were old enough to be my dad. None of them had any time for Jesus. They only ever mentioned him as a swear word, frequently. I remember Colour Sergeant Scholes, a nice man, and Company Sergeant Layden, whose tongue could lacerate at over 150 metres across the parade ground. Standing as a Christian was terrifying. I remember the first Sunday. Everybody else was doing something, going up to Colour Sergeant Scholes. "Colour Sergeant, I'm going to church." And you can only do that if you've got deep conviction. And as we head into chapter 10, we're going to find Jesus commanding us to proclaim from the rooftops what we have heard from him in secret, to make it known, to speak about it. And we can only do that, of course, if there is this deep conviction. But the evidence is here. You don't have to be ignorant, wandering around saying, "Oh, I wonder if Jesus really was God's king." No, the evidence is all there. We just have to open it up and look at it, which is why those Mark studies will be such a good thing to do. Well, I can hear somebody saying in the last few minutes, if these are deep times of deep conviction, that Jesus is God's king, and if he is the one who ushers in God's kingdom, then how come I had to go on holiday this year with all my luggage in a clear see-through plastic folder? Actually, when my kid had the polos taken off him, which is a feat, I might add, which I can't achieve in a million weeks, he had to put them in a plastic box. And everybody, you know, you walked, I don't know if it happened at your airport, it was going on at Bristol Airport, down in the West. And in the box, amazingly, was a builder's claw hammer. I mean, what kind of person takes a builder's claw hammer on the aeroplane? But anyway, that's beside the point. How come, if Jesus, you understand the question, if Jesus really is who he says he is, how come we're surrounded by death? How come we had a memorial service of a 30-year-old here yesterday? Well, I want us to look back into the narrative section to the one or two clues that make sense of this. The point is this, that we should be clear-headed in our conviction because Jesus never promised to usher in the physical effects of his kingdom here and now. Should I say that again? Jesus never promised to usher in the physical effects of his kingdom here and now. And we'll go back to chapter 8, verse 28 and 29 to see that, where two men in the grip of evil come to Jesus, and the evil forces that possess them in verse 29 cry out, and look at it very closely. Only Matthew puts it like this: "What have you to do with us, O Son of God," which means king, God's king, "have you come here to torment us," look, "before the time?" In other words, these evil forces know that there is a time when all who oppose Jesus Christ will be overthrown and all wickedness will be dealt with, and all that wrecks and spoils this world will be reversed. They know that this time is coming. But look again at the verse. Have you come here to torment us before the time? What are you doing here early, if you like? How come you're walking the earth now? Because the time is not yet. You get the same idea at the beginning of chapter 8, the same sort of idea mentioned in verse 11, just across the page there, where Jesus talks about the great feast at the end of time with Abraham, Isaac and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven. And he talks about those who reject Jesus being thrown into outer darkness. But notice verse 11, it's in the future. And then the idea is alluded to in chapter 9, we'll touch on this next week, where Jesus says the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. So that Jesus is quite clear in his teaching that he has, to say come early is not quite, I suppose, technically right, but he's arrived in advance of the establishing of his kingdom, absolutely. I illustrate this like this sometimes, and you may find this helpful. There is a period in mid-February, often in this country, when the gloom and misery of winter lifts for a week. Maybe you never feel it in London, but sometimes, it happens in the country. The sky is clear and the sun shines and you find a secluded corner well protected from the wind and you can almost think it's spring. And the birds begin to sing, and it's the wrong time of year to be saying this and using this illustration, but the odd flower pops up and you think of Wordsworth and all that sort of sentimental guff. But there is that little week and you say, yes, it's on the way. But then the low pressure comes in. Skies cover over and the sleet and snow resume. But you've had a taste, a feel for it. And as Jesus walked the earth, he demonstrated that the day is coming. He is the King. It will come. Sickness and death and suffering and chaos and disorder will come to an end when his kingdom comes. But the time for the physical arrival of his kingdom is not yet. And he makes that perfectly clear in later on in the Gospel, where he says, you will hear of wars and rumours of wars. You will hear of famine and people will persecute you. Don't think the time has come yet. But I am the King and I am the one who will usher in my kingdom. So now that helps us make sense of the times. Oh, by the way, I think Narnia captures it beautifully. If you've seen, you probably haven't had the excuse. If you've got little ones, you have an excuse to go and see these things. But the film of Narnia is wonderful. There's that moment early in the film, in Narnia, which is snowbound, when Aslan's name is mentioned and things just begin to thaw for a moment. And then winter sets in again. So here is this chapter designed to send us out into the harvest field as we prayed at the beginning. Verse 37, the harvest is plentiful, the labourers are few. Pray for the Lord to send out labourers. To send us out in the face of hostility. Designed to cause us to proclaim from the rooftops and to say openly who Jesus is. And it begins with this summary. Jesus is God's King. You can have real conviction, but be clear-headed about it. He didn't promise to usher in all the physical effects of his kingdom here and now. That's for them. But he is King, and he's shown it, and you can have real confidence of it. Well, next week we're going to look at the motive for proclaiming his kingdom. We're just going to look at verse 36. And what I'm going to call a time for gut-wrenching compassion. Do come back. Try and make the series. It holds together. It's a vital chapter. And if you can't be here, it will be on the website. You can download it onto your iPod. If you haven't got an iPod, this is a great excuse to get one. And you can listen to the talk on your way in or whatever. Let's pray together. The crowds marveled Never was anything like this seen in Israel. Father, we praise you for the gospel, the good news of the kingdom of Jesus. Thank you that he is the one with all authority to overthrow enemies and to deal with the wreckage of this world. Thank you for the prospect of his kingdom physically awaiting. Thank you for the wonder of it. And thank you for giving us such clear evidence that Jesus is the King. And I pray, Lord, that you would enable each of us to marvel as we think about Jesus, to marvel at him, to wonder at him, and to go out with real joy and courage, to be convicted of who he is, and so ready to proclaim from the rooftops. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.